Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back once again to the National Press Club. My name is Richard Salmon. I'm a writer with Congressional Quarterly, and I'm a member of the Board of Governors here at the Press Club. We extend our welcome to you. I'd also like to welcome all of those of you watching today's program on C-SPAN and those of you listening today on National Public Radio, and all of those of you accessing this program on the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our guests of some upcoming speakers. On Tuesday, September 21, attorney Elmer Johnson and American business expert will discuss the future of the large corporation in a fast-changing environment. On Wednesday, September 22, Judith Martin, otherwise known as Miss Manners, will talk about the etiquette of the press. Come on now, don't laugh, that's impolite. And on Thursday, September 23rd, the Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, will discuss congressional reform. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell, Chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, John Dingell, Secretary General of NATO, Manfred Warner, and Labor Secretary Robert Reich. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by dialing 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker today, please write them down on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to the head table. They'll be passed to me. I'll ask as many as time permits. I'd like now to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Linda Harrington of the Chicago Tribune, Tom Strong of the Associated Press, David Hawkins, Illinois correspondent for Thompson Newspapers, Jane Jenkins, counsel to Senator Simon, Senate Judiciary Committee, Robert Estill, Copley News Service, Mrs. Paul Simon, also known as Mrs. Jean Simon. Skipping briefly over our speaker, Christy Wise, freelance writer and vice chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. David Carl, press secretary to Senator Simon. Susan Spaulding, the Daily Oklahoman, and a member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Wendy Koch, Washington Bureau Chief, Small Newspaper Group. Mike Briggs, Chicago Sun-Times. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsbury, and Melanie Abdow-Dermott for organizing today's luncheon. After a long day at work, many Americans find themselves lodged in an easy chair watching the television, for better or worse. That's what happened one night in 1984 with Senator Paul Simon. He finished a long day of handshaking on the campaign trail and settled in for the evening at a hotel. Flipping on the television, he saw a person being murdered with a chainsaw. He didn't sleep well that night. Now that he's taking the lead in combating television violence, Hollywood executives are losing some beauty rest of their own. It's ironic that Simon, a former newsman, is taking the lead in combating television violence, even to the degree that some call straight, unadulterated censorship. 3 years ago, President Bush signed into law legislation authored by Senator Simon that gave the major television networks 3 years to take voluntary steps to curb violence on television. And last June, Hollywood responded by pledging to tone down violence and air advisories about programs considered unsuitable for young children. But does this represent effective and lasting change for the better? Some say the network's latest pledge is but the smallest of political fig leaves to be thrown at Washington and the powers that be in Congress. The fall TV lineup includes programs that reviewers say push further the envelope of acceptable violence. An example is NYPD Blue, yet another big mean city cop show that is rooted in violence and whose producers are oddly fascinated with the maniacs that roam the big cities. Sound familiar? It is. Hollywood says, relax, it's what Americans want. Don't make such a big deal about it. Violence on television, however, is an enticing issue for any politician to champion. Who now would vote against a bill whose aim is to protect children from unwholesome acts of blood and gore? The average American child watches 8,000 murders and 100,000 acts of violence before finishing elementary school, according to the American Psychological Association. And since the advent of television, as many as 3,000 studies have been launched to try to pinpoint the real effect that TV violence has on the crime rate. A spate of bills have been introduced in Congress this session to stem violence on TV. The newest ones include a bill that would give the Federal Communications Commission the power to define violence and thereby regulate it. Another one would require television sets to have computer chips inserted in them to allow parents to block objectionable TV shows. But Senator Simon says he does not prefer legislation, and he has indicated he won't support bills that go too far. Instead of legislation, Simon wants the industry to take voluntary steps, including setting up a citizens group to monitor television violence. Jack Valenti, president of the Motion Picture Association of America, sees Washington as being incapable of even having a proper role in this debate. He says, quote, we are opposed to any commission of mortals who are going to tell creative people what is right or wrong. For the record, the press club asked Valenti and network executives to appear here today to act as a counterweight to Senator Simon. They all declined. The senior senator from Illinois, Senator Simon, is in his second term in the Senate. He sought the Democratic nomination for president in 1988, and he was a member of the House of Representatives from 1975 to 1985. Prior to politics, he owned a string of weekly newspapers. And after retiring from politics, Senator Simon plans to go into the import-export business, selling bow ties full-time. Ladies and gentlemen, here to talk about violence and the boob tube is Democratic Senator Paul Simon.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you very, very much, Rich. You're the best dressed introducer I've had in a long time. I am pleased to be with you here, and I think it's appropriate to note before I launch into my subject that this is the beginning of the Jewish New Year, and what an exciting Rosh Hashanah this is with what took place at the White House 4 days ago. It's a little like the fall of the Berlin Wall. Doesn't mean that there aren't going to be difficulties ahead, but the landscape is permanently changed and changed for the better. We have a culture of violence in our country. You can pick up the morning newspaper, watch the TV news or any place else and learn about it. Tuesday's Chicago Tribune. Let me just read you three paragraphs from a story here. It was Mortal Monday, the release day for a home video game so bloody it comes in two versions, with or without the gore. The debut of Mortal Kombat, officially on Monday, though some stores started selling it as soon as they received copies last week, again raised questions about the effects of violence on children. Mortal Kombat is a fantasy martial arts game in which two opponents fight a three-round bout. When you've defeated your opponent, you can finish him by ripping his beating heart from his chest or tearing his head off, pulling out his spine along with it. Backed by a $10 million advertising campaign, Mortal Kombat is expected to sell 2 million copies in the next few months, said Aleen Mills of Acclaim Entertainment, Inc., the Oyster Bay, New York company that produces the game. She said the target market is 8 to 13-year-old boys. That suggests to me something is wrong in our culture. And part of what is wrong in our culture is glamorized entertainment, television violence. if we have 30 seconds worth of glamorized television on a bar of soap, we buy a bar of soap. If we have 30 seconds worth of glamorized television about a car, we buy a car. And if we have 25 minutes worth of glamorized television violence, unfortunately, we buy violence. That's the record. There is good news, bad news, and much uncertainty as we face the problem of glamorized television violence. The good news is that at the top level of the industry, there are some key leaders who acknowledge the reality that entertainment television violence adds to violence in our society. It is one of the causes of crime and other antisocial behavior. Fall broadcast programming will be less violent. That does not apply to reruns and will apply only marginally to cable. But the fare that most Americans view will be somewhat better, though the docudramas apparently will continue their present unhappy path. The agreement to have parental advisories is helpful beyond the obvious assistance to parents. Advertisers generally don't buy programs that have these advisories, so their reluctance to purchase violent programs will have a modest but welcome pocketbook effect. The good news is also the attention paid to the issue by the print media. I'm encouraged when TV Guide, for example, publishes an article by Jane Pauley which begins, "So what do you say when a little girl turns from the television set and asks, was he sticking a knife in her, mommy? It seemed perfectly clear that he was. So what my daughter really wanted to know was, why?" The bad news is that the majority of those who speak out from the television and film industry still do not acknowledge the tie-in between television entertainment violence and its negative effects on society. Even editorial writers are often unaware of the research. One of the reasons is obvious. Television has not covered the statements of the Surgeon General on television violence with the same thoroughness as it has similar statements on the cigarette threat. The fact that the National Institute of Mental Health twice has warned us about this problem is almost unknown. Research on this issue is overwhelming and points in one direction. There have been, at last count, more than 2,000 studies and reports, many of which are substantial, and in different ways they all deliver the same message, that glorified violence on the TV screen harms our society. As early as 1969, a national commission headed by Milton Eisenhower warned, and I'm quoting, "We are deeply troubled by television's constant portrayal of violence. It is pandering to a public preoccupation with violence that television itself has helped to generate." In 1969, when that report was written, research was limited. But today, research is solid and unquestioned by any serious scholar. The bad news is that in my August 2nd speech in Los Angeles, I challenged at least a few in the industry to occasionally broadcast a simple message, warning, watching too much television violence may be harmful. No major public health problem has been so studiously ignored by the TV industry as this one. I am unaware of any response to this challenge, but I will send a letter to the television stations and cable systems of the nation urging that at least once a day, this public service warning should be voluntarily aired. I understand why people in the tobacco industry do not want to acknowledge the harm that cigarettes do. And I understand why people in the television and entertainment industry do not want to acknowledge the harm that glamorized violence on television does. But those of us who do not have a financial stake in the industry must speak out forcefully. Something is wrong when a leading TV creator tells U.S. News, and I'm quoting, "There's more violence in the 5 o'clock news than anything you'll see on the networks during prime time," end of quote. What he fails to realize is that violence on the news is sometimes excessive, but does not glamorize violence. When we see what is happening in Bosnia, it is grim. When someone in Washington kills someone else, we see relatives crying. But what George Gerbner calls happy violence occurs on entertainment TV. Death is quick and certain and painless, and rarely is there a wife or mother on the scene grieving. On the news, violence is a grim, illogical way to solve problems. On entertainment television, violence is a logical means of eliminating problems. Something is wrong when a widely known children's program is produced in two versions, the violent one for the United States and the nonviolent one for distribution to the other nations of the world. When a spokesperson for the show was asked about that by the Christian Science Monitor, she replied that there is no objection to the violence in the United States, and by implication that they feel it adds to its saleability here, while other nations would not tolerate that. She said, and I quote, "At home, we don't get many objections to violence in our shows. American kids are used to it. But abroad, it's a very different story. The BBC in Britain wouldn't buy it unless they could edit out some of the violence. It's that version that we sold to the rest of the world. Otherwise, it wouldn't have done nearly as well." The good news is that three major polls show that the overwhelming percentage of the public recognizes the tie-in between television entertainment violence and crime. It is of interest that the higher the level of the education of the person polled, the greater the recognition of the problem. The good news is that electronic media polled 100 television station managers in all regions of the country and all market sizes, and 74% of them said television is too violent. When I speak to cable outlet managers, the reaction is the same. They are often ashamed of the product they sell. Also of interest, and perhaps of significance, is the Nickelodeon survey of young people ages 8 to 12 years old, which found that 80% said there is too much violence on television. 91% in this age group said that when they saw violence happening to real people on television, it bothered them, causing them to worry what might happen to them or their families. And 87% favored warnings at the beginning of a television show that has violence in it. The bad news is that there is still too much finger-pointing about who is responsible for television violence and crime, and too little concrete action. Broadcasting blames cable, which blames the movies. Executives say they use what producers give them. Producers blame the screenwriters, and the screenwriters say they script what they've been instructed to write. And then they all point the finger at others. Too many people in the TV industry say, "Why don't you do something about poverty?" or "Why don't you do something about guns?" And of course, they are right that we should tackle these things, and we have ducked. But they sound too much like the National Rifle Association leaders who blame everyone else for the cause of crime. That they're all in this grimy business together is illustrated by the Tech 9, the semi-automatic pistol used to kill 8 people and wound 6 in San Francisco. Mike Solo, marketing and sales director at the Intratech gun plant in Miami, which makes the Tech 9, said they weren't selling until they were used in a television series, and then sales shot up. The bad news is that extreme conduct invites extreme response. And when people in the industry deny the reality of the connection between entertainment television and crime, then some of my colleagues in Congress say that the only answer is legislation, and some of the legislation under consideration goes too far. Lawmakers should be cautious about entering the field of content, but those television moguls who worship the dollar more than responsibility to society invite legislative solutions. What is clear is that on broadcast programming this fall, there will be an improvement. My concern is that this improvement may be temporary, that a year from now we will face the same problems. That is why I strongly favor an independent monitoring committee that reports once a year to the public in specific terms about what the individual broadcast and cable networks are doing in presenting glamorized violence, on what is happening in the hours when children are most likely to watch, about what is happening with promos filled with violence. This is not a Hays Commission that pre-censors, but a body that reports the facts after viewing to the public. After initially reacting negatively to the idea, some leaders in the industry are now discussing this seriously. I hope they act favorably. And let me add that the committee established has to be of such a stature that its independence is not questioned. Recently, I talked on the telephone with the chief executive officer of one of the major networks. He told me, last night I saw a movie given a 4-star review by a major newspaper. There must have been 50 people shot up in the movie, and I'll bet it will be on home box office or Showtime soon. Or, he might have added, on one of the broadcast networks. There are many causes for violence in our society. We are doing an inadequate job in dealing with most of them, including television violence. If this industry does the right thing, we will continue to inch toward more responsible conduct. I want that trend to continue. If we do, the statistical data on crimes of violence will not suddenly plunge, but in 15 years, we will have a society measurably less violent. Thank you.
Thanks. We'll go to some questions from the floor that have been prepared for you. Senator, last June you appeared with heads of the four major television networks when they announced plans to start showing warnings on violent prime time shows to help parents protect their children. But with the fall television season opening, the networks say none of their series, old or new, will display violence advisories because they say they're not violent. Is the new season so violent-free that no warnings are needed? Have the networks gone back on their word given to you? And if so, what do you think should be done about it?
Well, it is not quite as grim as is suggested. There have now been 9 movies on which the cautionary words for parents have appeared. There will be one series on ABC that will have the advisory, and there may be more on other networks. So, again, we're inching ahead. Overall, the programming will be less violent. And I have to make an exception here again for the docudramas. There we still have some work to do.
Representative Ed Markey thinks all TV sets should come equipped with a computer chip that would enable parents to block shows that are violent. Do you support the so-called V-chip idea?
I'm not opposed to the TV chip idea, but frankly, it's not an answer to our problem. The difficulty with the TV chip idea is, first of all, most homes have more than one television set. Second, children are very ingenious on technical things. We all know that. I can't even record a program on our VHS, I hate to admit here, but when we need something done, we call upon one of our two children to get something like that done. There are other problems with that as the solution. And again, I'm not opposed to it, but it is not a substitute for changing the content, because the very homes that need this the most are the very homes where they will not have that chip. And then finally, when Johnny and Jane, your children, come up to you and say, "Can I go and play at the neighbor's?" you're a pretty tough parent if you will always say, no, you can't go and play at the neighbors. And then when Johnny and Jane come back and say, you should see what we saw on television. So the chip is, I'm not opposed to it, but I don't see this as the answer to our problem.
What has been the practical political fallout from your crusade? Have you lost endorsements? Have you lost PAC money from the studios or the networks?
I frankly don't know that there is any negative fallout politically. Incidentally, when talking about the TV chip, this has been advanced by Congressman Ed Markey, and he's one of a number who have really done good work. I don't mean this to be negative in the good work that he has done. Frankly, one of the reasons that so many people are coming aboard on this and so many bills have been introduced, and I suppose at least 10 senators have talked to me about other bills they're thinking about introducing, is that you have a confluence of just kind of intuitive belief that this television violence does harm, plus the research, and now you have these three public opinion polls. So I don't think anyone loses any points politically in coming out. But let me add, I haven't done this for political reasons. And I had a reporter the other day said, how come you're jumping on the bandwagon on television violence? I've been pushing this for some years when no one was paying attention to it.
Two questions related and combined. TV may glorify or desensitize violence, but clearly the social problems in the United States run deeper. Otherwise, Canada, which sees almost all U.S. TV shows, would have the same problems that we do. Beyond monitoring TV violence, what should our priorities be in the effort to reduce violence in our society? And along the same veins, but a little more abrupt, Jack Valenti said yesterday that if you cut the wires on every TV set in the United States, you will not find street violence in the United States diminished.
Well, I'm willing to take a test on that. The answer, of course, in Canada, you have very different regulations on a number of things. You have a great many weapons in Canada, but you also have rules on, you have a 28-day waiting period to get a gun, much stricter rules on who can become a gun dealer. So the city of Chicago last year had 927 deaths by firearms, 4.5 times as many as all of Canada. Toronto, roughly the same population as Chicago, had 17 deaths by firearms. And I am hoping, and incidentally some representatives of the National Rifle Association are here, I'm hoping that we may be able to work with them on something on gun dealers, where they acknowledge that something needs to be done. While they and I have been on opposite sides on a great many issues, this is one where I hope we can work together. But it is interesting, as I got into this whole issue, that Brian Mulroney, who was then the Prime Minister of Canada, called me and said, we're very much concerned about what you're doing. We're making progress on acid rain when you do harm to our bodies, but we don't seem to be making progress on TV violence where you're harming our minds. I think that is clear. Then the second question, what should we be doing? I think we have to pay attention to the problems of poverty, as was suggested in the question. There's no reason that our society should tolerate the kind of unemployment and lack of quality schools that exist in too many places. One out of five children in America lives in poverty. There's no other Western country that has that kind of a record of any major industrial country. I also believe in, my friends from the National Rifle Association differ with me on this, I think we have to have a waiting period on weapons, and I think we simply have to outlaw certain weapons, like the Tech 9 that I mentioned in my prepared remarks. Gene and I live down in southern Illinois. Our home is right next to the Shawnee National Forest. We have 12 acres out in the country. We're around hunters all the time. Most days when I'm home, and I'm not home very often, I see more deer than people, literally. I've never seen a hunter with an Uzi or an AK-47. You know, I want to see that responsible citizens can have guns. But I think there are certain weapons that we simply ought to outlaw in our society.
You will reportedly introduce legislation to create a National Privacy Protection Board. Would you describe your motivation and the charter that you envision for the board?
Well, I hadn't intended to announce it here today, but I will be introducing legislation for a National Privacy Board that, and the basic aim is to look at what is happening in this new world of computers and everything else that we have. Many nations have privacy boards of one kind or another. They have different names. We do not. And there really is an intrusion into the privacy of the lives of many of us, a much greater intrusion than most people realize. And I think having some kind of a monitoring board that says, are we really protecting the privacy of American citizens as we ought to? There is an implied right of privacy in the Constitution, I believe. We have had nominees before us who don't share that belief. But when you look at the requirement that you have to have a specific affidavit to go into your home to search for something, when you look at the requirement in the Constitution that says you can't have troops quartered in your home or be forced to have troops quartered in your home. And then a little known and little paid attention to amendment that is, I think, one of the really great amendments in the Bill of Rights. When Madison was talking about the Bill of Rights, he wrote to Hamilton. And Hamilton responded and said, if you spell out these are the rights of people, there will be people who will say these are the only rights they have. And so Madison added the Ninth Amendment, and it says, other rights not spelled out here are reserved to the people. I think that, by implication, when you take with the whole spirit of the Constitution, suggests that we have a right of privacy.
Who would appoint, and what would be the makeup of this independent monitoring committee? How would it be appointed?
I have not spelled out. The independent monitoring committee now applies to TV. Now, we're not this other matter that we just mentioned. I have simply suggested to the industry that you put together a committee. It has to be respected. And I suggested in my speech in Los Angeles to the executives out there that I just picked three names out of the air: Walter Cronkite, John Chancellor, or Newt Minow, the former chairman of the FCC. Someone who is respected, who knows the business, who isn't going to be on some kind of a vendetta against the industry, but who can once a year report, this is what's happening on NBC, this is what's happening on CBS, this is what's happening on HBO, this is what's happening during the hours when children watch the most. And if we have that annual monitoring report, I think we will see to it that we have an improvement in our television. My concern is, because of the pressure from a variety of sources now, we are going to have a lessening of TV violence this fall, but that a year from now and 2 years from now, we're going to be back up where we were before.
Hollywood celebrities often get involved in social causes. Which television or movie personalities have spoken out on TV violence?
Not very many. I would add there are some who have volunteered to me now that they would like to help. One was at the ceremony the other day and at the White House at the signing, and came up to me and indicated that he would like to be of assistance. I think there are others out there who are willing to stand up, but we need more in the industry to stand up. And it's very interesting, this is not an attack on the industry, interesting that the Screen Actors Guild years ago had a resolution, they've had several resolutions since, saying we have to reduce the amount of violence on the screen. Within the industry, there is an acknowledgement by some that this is a problem. The difficulty is the account book gets in the way of our sense of social responsibility.
How does what you're doing on regard to violence on television and entertainment being assisted by Attorney General Janet Reno and Donna Shalala, HHS?
I have not discussed this with the Secretary of HHS, Donna Shalala, but I have discussed it with Janet Reno. I have discussed it with others in the administration. And I was told by a member of my staff today that last night, or just recently, Secretary of Education Dick Riley made a speech in which he referred to this. There is, and the President has referred to this, even I noticed the Pope in flying to Denver in talking to reporters made a reference to the problem that television violence is causing. There is kind of an intuitive belief on the part of most people that this is really causing harm. What is not known is that there is solid research to back that intuitive belief. We're a little bit where we were back before the Surgeon General warned us about cigarettes. We all kind of knew that cigarettes did harm, but if we were polled, we would have said they did harm, but we didn't have that specific warning. In fact, the Surgeon General of the United States has on two or possibly three occasions given specific warnings on this. The National Institute of Mental Health has, but it has received virtually no attention. That's why I think we need to get that message. And even this simple advisory that I have suggested that TV stations use, warning watching too much television violence may be harmful, that is a way of buttressing that intuitive belief.
The questioner asks, Senator, is there a favorite film of yours that, by your own standards, is truly violent, such as Spartacus or Ben-Hur?
I'm going to stay out of this field. I, as you may note in my speech, I eliminated any references to specific shows, which show was that got the Tech Nine on, and which children's show it was. I have generally avoided naming movies or shows or anything else. I think I'm safer not getting onto that thin ice.
Like Michael Dukakis, aren't you one of those card-carrying members of the ACLU? How does this square with your efforts on violence and television?
I am a member of the American Civil Liberties Union, as George Bush says, a card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union. I used to be on the state board in Illinois, and I am proud of that affiliation. I want to defend the First Amendment, but I believe that it is not inconsistent to be a believer in the First Amendment and also to face up to problems we have in our society. After I had the first experience in this motel room, and I called my staff and says there has to be research somewhere on what happens to children, and then I learned there was all kinds of research and we had all this evidence, I called a meeting of representatives of the TV industry in my office and said, I'd like you to establish standards because I don't want to have censorship, but we have to recognize we have a problem. And the vice president of one of the networks said, well, we've done research that shows there doesn't do any harm to have television violence. And I said, you remind me of the Tobacco Research Institute people who come in here and say they have research showing that cigarettes don't do any harm. I said, there's no question about the harm. The question is, how do we in a free society deal with it? And so I have refrained up to this point in asking for any kind of action by the FCC or anyone else. And I would like to avoid any kind of governmental action. But I have to add, this is a serious problem. And the industry has to recognize it is a serious problem. And there has to be some kind of response that is beyond what we have had now. I am pleased they have some voluntary standards that they have agreed to. They came to me last December with some standards that they have agreed to. And that's an improvement, though I have to add some of the standards are a little spongy, like no gratuitous violence. That's what is gratuitous and what isn't. But I think we need that monitoring board. I think that's the key that can really say we're going to do something into the future that is meaningful.
What is your stand on another aspect of violence in popular culture, that being song lyrics, rap, for example, that seem to describe terribly violent acts?
I'm obviously offended by many of these things, as are others, but let me just say I have my plate full dealing with television violence, and I think I better stick to that.
You mentioned earlier that you expect the industry to impose curbs on violence in the next year or two, and then probably they'll inch their way back up again. Did I characterize correctly?
That's my fear.
Now, your fear, let's say you carry that down the line again. If your angle is to continually combat it with voluntary curbs, is there a line in the sand that Hollywood will pass and you say, all right, we've tried everything we can, we're going to come through with some tough legislation? What would it look like?
I think there is a line in the sand. And I think the line in the sand is, will we have a monitoring group? And if there is not a monitoring group, whether Paul Simon wants it or not, we're going to have legislative reaction. There is the possibility that I have thought about, if the industry doesn't come up with a monitoring group, maybe we could have a foundation or some foundations going together to do this. But that is, when you get foundation support, you may get it for 3 years or something like that. And I frankly don't want to be in the fundraising business and going around knocking on doors for this kind of thing. If there is not a response, a positive response by the industry to the idea of monitoring, we're headed for some type of legislative response. What that will be, I don't know.
Is there any data that you're familiar with that show a real per capita increase in violence in America since 1970? Can you cite any of that data off the top of your head?
Well, I can't cite specific data in terms of the increase in violence. There is the one study published by the American Medical Association Journal that did a study of isolated villages in the United States, Canada, and South Africa, and found a fairly consistent pattern that when television was introduced 15 years later, there was the figures varied, but there was an increase of about 50% in murders, rapes, and assaults. Now, I am hesitant to lean on one statistic, but there are a whole series of studies, and they all show the same thing. And you may find a flaw in this study or a flaw in that survey, but you just can't deny the whole bulk of the research that is out there. And there is no serious scholar who questions the research and the direction of this. The one bit of research by a professor now at the University of Michigan has been following for a number of years people starting at the age of 8 and in determining what is the crime pattern and so forth. And he found in his research for people who have now reached the age of 30 that the pattern for those who have been involved in criminal activities, more important than race, more important than family, whether the family was a cohesive family or not, more important than the level of income, was how much television was watched at the age of 8.
You're an author of 12 books, I believe, and a weekly newspaper column that goes out to a number of subscribers. The questioner asks along that line, doesn't television, not just TV violence, but just television, have a harmful effect that it makes us a less literate society?
And I speak with a conflict of interest here, obviously. I think we watch too much television. I think we ought to read more books. I think we ought to try to get a little greater depth in what we do in our society. Seeing Pat over here, I think we ought to go to more symphony concerts. We ought to be doing others. At the same time, I think we have to recognize that television has enriched our society in many ways, and that C-SPAN, we're on C-SPAN right now, has brought us the House and the Senate and our committees in action. I think that has been an important contribution. And I can think of any number of ways in which television has made a very solid contribution. So I am not here with an attack on television. Do we watch more than we should per week, the average American? I think, yes, we do. I think we'd be better off doing a little more reading, doing some other things to enrich ourselves a little more.
We might leave the subject of television for a little bit if you wouldn't mind answering some questions unrelated to it. What is your position on the North American Free Trade Agreement? Do you get phone calls from Ross Perot on it?
I have not received a phone call from Ross Perot on that. I have not made a public declaration yet on my decision in this area. I am still doing some research. It is a complicated area. I do think that we, among the factors that we have to weigh, are our future relationships with Mexico. I also believe the short-term result is fairly clear. Mexico is one of the few countries where we have a favorable trade surplus, the United States selling to Mexico more than Mexico sells to us. And when you reduce tariff barriers that average 15% in Mexico and 4% in the United States, as you eliminate those, the beneficiary clearly will be United States industry, so that there will be a job plus here in the United States. What is a little less clear is the long-term impact. And one of the things I'm doing is looking at research on what happened to the European community when Spain, Portugal, and Greece were added. You have a richer central body where three poorer countries were attached. It is not completely analogous, but is somewhat analogous to the situation that we're going through.
Questioner, I'd like to get your opinion and outlook on health care legislation next year. How important is the health care legislation coming up to the Clinton administration? Will his presidency founder, if a credible health care bill is not on the books, will he be a one-term president without a big health care bill?
And all of that in 30 seconds. The answer is I don't think we ought to be looking at this in terms of what's going to happen to a Clinton re-election or Paul Simon re-election or anyone else's re-election or election. I think we ought to look and say what is and ask what is the national need. And clearly there is a national need in this area. And I think we will get legislation. I serve on one of the two Senate committees of jurisdiction. Our committee will try to report out, I believe, by the end of the year, legislation. That means it would go to the Senate if the other committee reports at roughly the same time. That means after the first of the year, it will be on the floor of the Senate. I think it is possible that by April 1st, we could have health care legislation. The president will be spelling out the details more next week, but it will include universal coverage. It will include some cost control. It will include cards for each of us so that when we go into a hospital or go to a physician's office, we can use that without filling out all kinds of papers. There will be requirements on insurance companies to simplify and make clear what they're selling to us, there will be a requirement for uniform forms by the insurance companies. But there are a great many things that are unanswered. But I think it is clear this nation can't continue to let 37 million people go without health insurance and to have a great many other Americans underinsured.
In the beginning of your speech, you mentioned the Middle East peace agreement as a momentous beginning for the new Jewish New Year. Yasser Arafat was on the Hill earlier this week in private meetings with Senator Mitchell and Dole and with House members. While they didn't go into too many details about what they spoke about, it's almost certain that he was asking for some type of assistance, whether it be reviewing the laws to see how economic assistance can be provided, whether it's loan guarantees. With the foreign aid bill coming through Congress, foreign aid appropriations bill, do you see any reason to believe that money might be shifted from Egypt or Israel to assist Palestine?
I don't think money is going to be shifted from Israel or Egypt, but I think we have a responsibility to assist in the problems that the Palestinians will face. I have been a strong backer of Israel. I make no apologies for that. I think it has been in our national interest as well as a historic responsibility that we have to a people who have been persecuted over the centuries. But what we have to do is, in our national interest, for a great variety of reasons, including the basic issue of oil, we have to see that there is stability in the Middle East. And I think that that means we have to see that this agreement works. And that means helping the Palestinians as they face problems in the Gaza Strip, in Jericho, and in other areas. Yes, I think we have a responsibility here, and we should live up to it.
On another matter of foreign affairs, on Monday, President Clinton further eased the trade embargo on Vietnam to allow U.S. companies to partake in multi-million-dollar contracting that will be financed by the World Bank. Many Democrats and Republicans feel that the embargo should be lifted, and some say it will be lifted by the end of the year. Do you believe that lifting the embargo and normalizing relations with Vietnam will be an insult to families of the missing that have not been accounted for?
Pat Hayes and I are the only ones here old enough to remember after World War II when Harry Truman said, we're going to help Germany, we're going to help Japan. And I remember how controversial that was. but it was the right thing to do. We haven't faced up to our responsibilities as far as Vietnam is concerned. That war is over. And in my state of Illinois, Caterpillar wants to sell to Vietnam. Japan is in there selling, Taiwan is selling, France is selling, the British are selling. Why can't we do this? Foreign policy should cater to the national interest, not to the national passion. What we're doing in Vietnam is catering to the national passion. There are some times when you just have to stand up and do some things that are not popular. This is one where clearly we ought to get this war behind us. We ought to be there doing what we can to sell and to stand up for human rights in Vietnam. The record of that government is not a good record. But to continue to isolate ourselves from Vietnam is not in the interest of the people of Vietnam, and it is not in the interest of the people of the United States.
We have two more quick questions. The first one, this could be a one-word answer, I'm not sure. Do you plan another run at the presidency?
No.
And before asking our last question, I would like to present to you a certificate of appreciation from the National Press Club. It's signed by the president of the club, Clayton Boyce, and given with great honor to you. Thank you.
I thank you very much.
We also have a very expensive coffee mug, which I believe is under $20 value, so you can take it, I believe, right? So that's your answer.
I thank you very, very much.
Last question is, a lot of Shakespearean plays have violent scenes in them. Macbeth, for instance, ends with a great beheading. Henry V is terribly violent. If Shakespeare were alive today, do you think he would be fond of you and what you're doing?
Well, I can't really speak for Shakespeare, believe it or not. But if I may, in a somewhat more serious vein, say British television, the land from which he hailed, says that a death should not be on television screen unless it is absolutely essential to the plot. It is the British television is like the old Greek tragedies, where the murders appeared off stage, and in British television, they appear off screen. I think we can learn from the land of Shakespeare. Thank you very much.